Last week, we began the ambitious project of studying the book of Daniel, one of the most remarkable lives and perhaps the most remarkable set of visions in the Bible. We learned that Daniel was a teenager who was ripped from his Jewish home by the Babylonian Empire, taken to Babylon, and shaped to be a Babylonian, having everything that a young man looks forward to in life stripped away. Now, I said last week that by the time that he and his friends arrived in Babylon, they were committed to embrace a faith, to embrace a God much bigger than they had previously realized. They had to, giving up the story that they had sketched for their lives in favor of becoming part of God's story. Now, in this next section, which is in chapter 1 still, starting in verse 5, you'll see why I came to that conclusion and how this new faith very first manifested itself. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Daniel entered what was essentially a university experience. He learned Babylonian language and culture and history. I'm sure he received courses in Babylonian science and mathematics. After an examination, at the end of that time, he and the others would be assigned royal duties, becoming full-fledged Babylonians who represented Nebuchadnezzar's Jewish subjects. Now, one of the perks provided these young men from the very beginning was a daily portion of the food and drink of the king. Now, most people in the kingdom, of course, only ate meat on very special occasions, only drank wine that was mixed with water to make the water safe. The king, of course, had a daily portion of meat and drank his wine straight. To share his larder and his wine cellar with somebody was a major perk, because it wasn't just about the food itself, which was pretty special in itself. It was the honor of the king sharing his table with you. It would be like the White House providing a limousine for you when you travel, or being assigned an office on the same floor as the CEO. It's not just the car or the office in itself, it's what it means to be awarded such a thing. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. Part of their orientation was to receive new names. These were not new names. These were official names. Daniel, which had meant God is my judge, was renamed Belteshazzar, which is Bel protects his life. Bel was the another word for Marduk, who was the chief god of the Babylonians. Hananiah, the Lord has been gracious, was renamed Shadrach, fear of Aku. The Aku was the moon god. Mishael, who is God, was renamed Meshach, who is Aku. Not a lot of imagination there, but that's all right. Azariah, the Lord has helped, was renamed servant of Nebu. Nebu was the son of Marduk. He was kind of the patron god of scribes. I imagine he was being trained as a scribe. These are the names that would, so to speak, appear on their driver's license. This is where their official names. This formally demonstrated that these Hebrews had become Babylonian subjects. But Daniel resolved he would not defile himself with the king's food, nor with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. Consider Daniel's very interesting first choices in Babylon. On the one hand, he accepts the new name, which is the name of an idol, okay, because he accepts the fact that he is a Babylonian citizen. But he rejects the king's food. Rejecting his new name would have been a public affront to the king, insulting the king's gracious offer to give him Babylonian citizenship. But while Daniel always maintained an appropriate humility before the king, he discreetly maintained his independence. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, "I fear the Lord my king, who assigned your food and your drink, for why should he see that you are in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king." Daniel's immediate supervisor was sympathetic to him. God gave Daniel favor with this man. Daniel was good. He was a good, obedient, helpful, respectful student. He made the supervisor look good. But would this change if his diet changed? Notice from the very beginning, this arrangement was to be a secret a discreet decision of Daniel and his friends, not known by anybody except his supervisor who had to make it happen. Then Daniel said to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see." And again, notice, at no time was the king to know anything about this. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance, fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. Well, now we know this is going to be kept a secret, because if the king found out the steward was doing this, he'd probably get in trouble. So the steward would keep his mouth shut. So from then on, they did not eat the king's food. The king never knew that, but Daniel and his friends did. Every time they appeared before the king inside, they could secretly reflect how they were not eating the king's food. As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And that will be developed, of course, very soon in the book. God caused them to excel in their studies. This is the first example of the outward success that God gave these young men in a pagan land, because inwardly, they kept their heart pure for him. At the end of the time, that is at the end of the 3 years, when the king had commanded they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them, and among all of them none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they stood before the king, and in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all of his kingdom. Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. So we see at this very beginning that Daniel's success is because he just did a fantastic job, and God caused him to be able to do that. Why did Daniel and his friends finagle things so that they would secretly abstain from the king's food? Now, some say they were being faithful to Jewish dietary restrictions. Maybe that's how it began. Daniel used the word defile. But of course, that word doesn't necessarily mean ceremonial. It can also mean moral. But I don't think that's the main reason. For one thing, most of the king's menu wouldn't have been a problem. It would have been much easier just to not eat the occasional, you know, pork chop or whatever. But the main thing is that the Old Testament did not forbid wine. That was a staple in Jewish diet. And yet Daniel did not want to have any of the special food the king gave him, including the wine. That tells me that it was not really motivated by dietary laws. Some think Daniel was avoiding food offered to idols. And it's true that all the food they ate was offered to idols. But that would be the problem with that, because the vegetables were offered to idols too. So that wasn't the reason. What Daniel and his three friends did was to discreetly refuse the special perks offered to him by the king. You know, the CEO might have offered you a luxurious office, but you quietly arrange to get a smaller and less obtrusive one so you can be nearer to the people you're working with. And since the CEO is never going to visit your office, he'll never know. Why did Daniel do this? Because of an unwritten rule in every organization. Whoever eats the king's food is the king's man. It manifests itself in many ways, from a parking space with your name on it to an increase in your pay grade. When you get more perks, it is often expected that there will be more loyalty. 4 decades ago, that's a long time. 4 decades ago in my first church, I experienced this for the first time. I worked with an elder who, let's say, he liked to control things from behind the scenes. Occasionally, he would bring home with him from his processing plant boxes of dented cans of food that were destined to be thrown out. As he well knew, I had a very, very small salary at the time, so extra food would be appreciated, which it was. And then one day, another elder took me aside, a guy who worked for him, okay? He just said one sentence. He said, "Glenn, you know, that free food's going to get quite expensive." That's all he said. It was a warning from someone who knew him much better than I that this generous elder wanted me in his pocket, like the other pastors had been. From that point on, Mickey would thank him for his thoughtfulness and quietly throw it all away. I'm not sure how healthy dented cans would have been anyway. We discreetly refused to become dependent on those gifts. Now, he never knew what we did. We never embarrassed him privately or publicly in any way. But in every session meeting, regardless of what he thought, I knew that he did not have me in his pocket. We're going to see Daniel do some amazing things with his king. He's going to say some amazing things. He's never going to be disrespectful. He is never going to be antagonistic, but he's going to say difficult things that the king did not want to hear, things that other retainers would be far too scared to say. And this made Daniel an excellent spokesman for God, because what good is a spokesman who is too compromised to deliver the message? How could Daniel maintain such integrity, which really becomes legendary in the scriptures? Well, here we see that at every meal, he privately reminded himself that he was not the king's man. He was the king's servant by God's decree, but he was not the king's man. He was the Lord's man. That wasn't some ego-building, macho public position. It was a quiet, personal, secret patch of his own lifestyle that essentially only he and God knew about. And that's all who had to know about it. You know, societies and authorities maintain their control in different ways. Each one will use intimidation, some form of force or threat. Remember how the Romans favored that. That was their go-to. We'll see Babylonian intimidation pretty soon, too, in this book. But every society's arsenal also includes seduction, offering some kind of perk, some kind of privilege or pleasure in exchange for loyalty, a lot of loyalty. Seduction is the art of getting you to compromise your convictions. It's not just a matter about rewarding what you've done. It's about compromising your convictions to secure your source of pleasure or advantage. Babylonians preferred to seduce first. That's the way they did it. And in terms of control, seduction is far more sophisticated and far more effective choice. Think about it. Intimidation forces obedience. But if you let your guard down, the people under you will rebel because they're obeying against their will. Seduction is better because it gets people to sell out. Once seduced, you are your own jailer. You obey quite willingly in order to get your fix, whether it be drugs or power or prestige or whatever. Seduction is a very powerful technique. The word is most often associated, I guess, with sexual temptation, but it's symbolic of anything you are willing to sell your virtue to get. Anything you will compromise your integrity or your convictions in order to maintain. In the White House, that thing might be power. In a street gang, it might be respect and belonging. The Bible's quite clear about who's responsible for seduction. Seduction is so effective because while others are responsible for making it possible, you alone are responsible for letting it happen. An authority, an institution, a society seduces you simply by letting you seduce yourself. Babylon was willing to spend some money and effort up front to let these young men seduce themselves, not in the area of sex, but in the prestige of being close to power. And then, you know, nice meals. And once they gave in to that simple perk of the best food and drink, other perks would be sure to come. They would begin to think they deserve these things and they need these things, and with an increasing requirement of loyalty in order to maintain them. So that in the end, they would become the king's willing slaves. Or should I say prostitutes? Because that's the biblical language. That's the biblical illustration of what's happening. John had a vision in the book of Revelation. I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. This is a vision of John, the Apostle John, of the cultural seduction that would take place during the whole period of the last days. It portrays how society after society will seduce Christians to compromise their faith, not just sexually. Sex is symbolic of any kind of prostitution, any kind of selling out or selling of yourself to support the beast that she's riding. Such compromise destroys the church every bit as much as the sword. Intimidation openly wounds the church from the outside, but seduction secretly hollows it out from the inside. The church can even prosper externally while internally compromising more and more and more. Compromise begets compromise, and the more you do it, the easier it is to justify. It's essential that we recognize and we deal with the things in our society that seduce us. So, I talk about my problems. I'll give you an example. Dangerous temptations in my life. When Mickey and I walk in the Annapolis Mall, I have to prepare myself when approaching Victoria's Secret, right? I know that just glancing at that store will cause a flash of raw lust in me, unavoidable, if I choose to look. So I'm very, very careful to look to the right and not to the left. That's great. Problem is, when I look to the right, I see the Apple Store. This is my problem. I said, I'm sorry, excuse me, all right. Okay. Now, I never peek at Victoria's Secret ads in my computer at home, but I do check on the upcoming MacBook Pro about every week, see how it's coming. Now, just so you know, Mickey and I, in order to combat such things, we agree on a budget that covers virtually all of our income. We both know exactly where all of our money goes. And she can tell you I've been saving up for a new machine for several years. We are committed never to buy anything we don't have the money for. But if I let myself, I would spend a fortune in this place using money I don't have. That's the power of seduction. When we buy things, as an example, that we can't afford, we have compromised our faith. Faith that tells us that Christ wants us to provide for our families. He wants us to provide for our church. He wants us to provide for the poor and other needs in society. He wants us to provide for our own rest and renewal and development. And when we misappropriate our money, we can't care appropriately for our family. We can't care appropriately for the church. We can't care for the poor. We can't care for our own responsible renewal and growth. We compromise our faith. And Babylon the prostitute cuts down yet another Christian's influence. Our families are slighted, our church is hobbled, our society never experiences the grace of Jesus Christ, and we exhaust ourselves in recreations that do not build us up. And in the end, what starts out as a decision to indulge turns into a full-blown addiction in which we aren't consciously deciding things anymore. It's simply how we just live or feel like we have to live. You once had boundaries that allow your faith to flourish, but now you can't resist the allure of temptation because you have torn down the walls of your faith yourself. Daniel purposed to have a larger faith, faith in a larger God, and make that the centerpiece of his life. He was serious about it because it was either that or give up faith entirely. If he was going to believe in the biblical God, then he was going to have to believe it would be better to have a part in God's script than to write his own life story. Believing in a larger God like that is not easy. Such faith is going to have to brave the world's intimidation and the world's punishment and the world's anger. But first, it has to brave the world's seductions. Because if it can't do that, if our faith, if our God is smaller than our dinky pleasures and prestige, then no intimidation by our society will be necessary. We will have already neutralized ourselves. Daniel saw what the king was doing by sharing his larder in his wine cellar. Perhaps all the young men did. But hey, what's wrong with a few perks? We deserve it. And there isn't anything wrong with perks if you can be free from the strings. Daniel just realized when he went into this, the king of Babylon had strings on everything, and he wasn't quite sure if he was able to resist that. So he decided to take a stand. Paul made a similar point about free gifts having a serious price tag. He said that the worst slavery is the self-created slavery of seduction. You give yourself to somebody as a slave, you're a slave. They don't have to make you if you give yourself. Those who eat the king's food are the king's men. Daniel would serve Nebuchadnezzar well. I think he served him better than anybody else. And I think the king came to realize that. But he would never be the king's man. He belonged to the Lord. Whatever that meant, whatever it took him, that's what it meant. And he rehearsed that privately, discreetly, secretly, every breakfast, every lunch, and every dinner. Every meal was a small little recommitment which God witnessed every day in Daniel's life. And God responded to that man by choosing to reveal through him the most comprehensive understanding of redemptive history in the Old Testament. We're going to need a faith that's larger than our culture's seductions. We're talking about a larger faith this series. The future of the American church, perhaps our nation, depends on American Christians resisting the seductions of American culture. Not that we shouldn't like good things or be rewarded for our effort, not at all. But we have to avoid the strings that come with that, that would lead to compromise of our convictions. It is just pointless to point the finger at misguided convictions of other people if we won't live by our own. It's pointless to worry about whether the walls of our faith can withstand intimidation and persecution if we tear down the walls ourselves for the sake of pleasure and prestige or power. Every day, this society, my job, my government, my school, even my friends and social group will offer me something nice, sometimes really nice, something I really want, to buy loyalty that belongs to God alone. To get me to compromise what I believe he wants me to do so I can have this. So a question that occurs to me is what is going to remind me that I am the Lord's man and that I am the Lord's woman? Perhaps an earlier question actually is appropriate. Am I the Lord's man or the Lord's woman? Have I ever explicitly chosen the Lord over something I really wanted but knew down deep would compromise my faith? Have I ever done that? I hope you will pardon my bluntness, but if you can't think of any examples, you've probably never done it. Because it is hard to choose the Lord over something which is truly capable of seducing you. And it's not something you forget. You might think, why bother? God knows my heart. I don't have to prove anything to him. No, of course not. But this is not about what God knows. This is about what I know about myself. Daniel needed to rehearse God's grace, faithfulness, covenant regularly. And he also had to rehearse his commitment in response so that he would not lose his soul in Babylon. So he lost no time demonstrating privately to himself that he was God's man. He needed to do that for himself. And if making such a secret choice once was life-affirming, how much more powerful to maintain a secret life of devotion every day, every single day. You know, a truly personal relationship with God needs some strictly private intimacy. Strictly private intimacy. Daniel had the courage to obey God and speak for God publicly, in part because of a secret life he had with God that nobody saw. Every time Daniel stood before the king, his latest meal secretly reminded him whose man he was. And the king never knew. He didn't have to know. Daniel had to know. Jesus said that regular prayer and regular fasting should be strictly private things. No one else should know, at least not because I talk about it. To talk about it is to spoil it. This is something that is precious and private between you and God. Maintaining secret expressions of devotion reminds me on who I serve and who I depend on because of his love and grace. It reminds me whose script my life is following. It reminds me that God is always with me, even when nobody can see him. And it helps me to take faith outside of the religious context and realize that my God is large enough for any context. I can't share with you my secret devotion practices with God. Not even Mickey knows them all. It's important for me to have a private life with God that only he and I know about. To share it would spoil it. Brothers and sisters, let the world think, demand, hope what it will. We are not the property of the king. And we know that, not by defying authorities God has established. That would dishonor our God. We know that the king doesn't own us when we're not seduced by the king's food. Such confidence grows out of private decisions known to God alone to choose him over the things that would compromise our relationship. He sees it. And God uses such secret choices to shape people who build his kingdom. Let's pray. Father, I am so grateful that this private early decision of Daniel's came out later after he was gone in his memoirs or the memoirs of his friends writing this. Such a small thing, his private menu. But what a channel of spiritual power. It just shows an attitude, a life. Father, your son purchased us at the cost of his blood. We rightfully belong to you, but we do confess that we are often tempted to compromise that belief, that conviction, that ownership of yours to gain something we crave. Father, some of us, at least right now, we're going to ask you to help us create a private secret, a small, regular act of faith no one knows about but you. Something that quietly and repeatedly reminds us whose man or woman we really are. Hear us, Father, for Jesus' sake. Amen.